Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Richard Holm, and I'm chairman of the Hansard Society. And some of you may know it's our 60th anniversary this year, and we've had amazing activities, celebrations going on all year, seminars, projects, consultations, publications, more than you can shake a stick at. We've had parties at Number 10 and at the Speaker's House. We've had a magnificent exhibition in Westminster Hall, which I hope some of you were able to come to. We have a special edition of Parliamentary Affairs. But of everything we're doing, the one I think that gives me personally the most pleasure is the celebratory conversation tonight between David Butler and Tony Benn. These are two old friends. In fact, if I can ask a very rash question, how many people in this audience were alive in 1943? Could you bear to put your hands up?
Well, you and I better.
Okay, a significant minority. But that was the year that Tony and David first met at New College, Oxford, and I think it's fair to say that they've been friends ever since. And both of them have had unusually interesting lives within the political arena. Tony Benn really doesn't need any introduction from me because his record is well known, but Member of Parliament, Cabinet Minister, Democrat, Parliamentarian, Socialist, Controversialist. In fact, I was struck that even his biography, which is down here, and which I'm told by the publisher you'll be able to buy copies afterwards, even maybe signed copies, but even that has a challenging title. I read Dare to be a Daniel as though it were a challenge, Tony, rather than a description of your own life. And then there's David Butler, who was and has been for years the shrewdest chronicler of British elections and the doyen of British cephology. In fact, I'm not sure, David, whether you didn't invent the term cephology. He did.
I didn't actually.
And David and Tony have both in different ways been very good friends of the Hansard Society. Indeed, David was my predecessor as chairman of the Society. But whatever these ties of friendship between them and the Hansard Society, I'm quite certain that we're in for some fairly straight talk this evening and an illuminating and fascinating discussion. David, over to you.
Well, I don't know, is this mic'd and so on? I think you're not here to listen to me. You're here to listen to the most brilliant and funny and perverse of politicians in the last half century. And though I'm now going to question Anthony about his life, which I have watched closely over 60 years, it is an occasion. I would like to draw attention first to the fact he's got a pot of tea there, and the Hansard Society has generously given me some wine. In fact, I've always thought it's a very good thing that Anthony was a total abstainer, hereditary total abstainer, because he's always seemed to me slightly drunk with life. But anyway, it was in 1943, as Richard said, that a very shy new undergraduate at New College at the top of the Robinson Tower, in charge, this extraordinarily young-looking aristocrat, as I saw him, say, "You're Butler, aren't you? We're doing economics tutorials together." And so for the next two terms, before we went off to war service in our different ways, we had tutorials in economics from a very incompetent tutor, I now think, and certainly he didn't manage to make either of us economists. But still, there it is. Now, I think we should start going back before that first encounter. I remember my mother took me when she went to vote in the Macdonald election of 1931. What is your memory of the 1931 election?
I remember my dad being defeated. It's quite straightforward. I met Ramsay Macdonald in 1930 because his daughter wrote to my mother and said, "Would you like to bring your sons to the Trooping of the Colour?" And I went there, and when I got back, I said I had expected to meet the Prime Minister, but I didn't expect chocolate biscuits. And I've looked on Labour leaders with chocolate biscuits with considerable suspicion ever since. And of course, even earlier, you see, if we're going to the beginning, I met a Labour MP in 1928, very young, handsome MP, and I was three. Next time I saw him was 7 years later in a black shirt in Parliament Street. It was Oswald Mosley, the Kilroy Silk of his day. And so these memories are etched deep in my memory.
But, well, 1935, I remember I was 11 and I wanted to stand, I'm afraid as a Conservative, in the mock election at my prep school. But what is your memory of 35?
Well, certain consistency on your part, but...
No,
I went out distributing literature, and I've still got all the literature, because I've kept everything. It's a terrible thing to do. It's in 9 garages, but I've got everything I've ever had. And I've got the leaflets I put out for Mr. Kennedy, who was the Labour candidate in the Abbey Division of Westminster. And one of the leaflets I put out at the time, I pulled out recently, well, 25 years ago, and it was issued by the Miners' Federation of Great Britain. And it pointed out that between the end of the general strike in 1935, over 1 million miners had been injured and 7,800 had been killed in the pits. So I just reproduced it during the miners' strike and distributed it and said, that's what private ownership of the pits means. And I think going back on these things, and not for any other purpose than to deepen your own understanding of what happened. So I did campaign in the 35 election and later in the 45 election.
But did Spain make a difference?
Well, we discussed Spain all the time at home. I remember the Spanish the Japanese attack in Manchuria in 1931, the Spanish Civil War, and I wonder if anyone remembers the name of Potato Joe, who was a very brave sailor who took his boat into Bilbao during that. And I opposed appeasement and all that. I've got a school essay I wrote on the Spanish Civil War, and underneath my teacher wrote disgusting. Because I attacked Franco.
Well, let's jump to 45. What are your memories of the 45 election?
Well, it was really the war. I mean, you, David, drove a tank across the Rhine and sank it. I didn't have any such courageous period. I just learned to fly. It took a long time, and I never killed anyone. It was just a considerable threat to myself. But the thing about the war, for those who've never been in it, is war is 99% boredom and 1% a real danger. And during the period of boredom, you talk. And going out in a troop ship in 44, I went to see the commanding officer of troops. I was an aircraftman second class, the lowest rank, and I saluted and said, could we have a debate on war aims? And the colonel said, war aims? Nothing political, I suppose. I said, no, certainly not. And we had a wonderful discussion about what we do after the war, because, you see, if you want to know why Labour won in 45, it's very simple. We just talked all the time, and we said there was mass unemployment in the 30s, and we have full employment to kill Germans. Why can't we have full employment to build hospitals, build schools? And that's why we won in 45. It was the arguments that came out of the experience of talking in war. And it wasn't anti-Churchill, it was just we wanted a better world. Not that I'd ever had any period of deprivation, but that was the argument. So the 45 election, I drove a loudspeaker van around Westminster, same constituency. My job was to drive round Peggy Ashcroft, and she lectured people in Cowsing Estates about the need for a national theatre.
Well, let's think back to 45 to 47. We both got back rather unexpectedly early from the war, and in the autumn, Michaelmas term 45, we were both back at New College. And then, of course, you shot up in the Union, and I used to scrutineer on your behalf the votes as they came in and so on. But what do you think Oxford did for you those 2-3 years?
Well, I can't say that it had much to do with my education in the formal sense. I don't remember, I was studying modern greats, I think, politics, philosophy, and economics. Marx wasn't mentioned, except I think one man, lecturer, said he was wrong. That was the only reference to Marx throughout the whole of my education. And it was very, very limited, but what was really valuable was meeting people and talking. And you see, I've learned everything by listening. I'm not a great reader. I find decoding 26 letters terribly tiring. But listening to people, and in those post-war years, you know, we talked all the time, and the politics was much the dominant consideration in my mind. And of course, you were studying then cephology. David did invent cephology. He discovered that the cephos was a helmet into which the Greeks put their vote. And if you want to be an expert, invent your own subject before you start. And no one has challenged his cephology ever since.
But, Anthony, that is absolutely characteristically inaccurate.
but very funny.
I didn't invent zoology. I only put it into print for the first time. It was invented by other people. And it's not a helmet, it's a pebble. Psephos is the Greek for a pebble.
I thought it was the
helmet. No, a pebble. It doesn't matter. It's not these antiquarian matters. But when you were in Oxford, you rose in the Union, and you went on a debating tour. And that's a vivid picture. Edward Boyle, Sir Edward Boyle Baronet, and Kenneth Harris, later a very famous journalist, and you went on the Union debating tour in America. And I was a graduate student at Princeton at the time, and I entertained you there in Princeton. That was your first experience of America. What did that do to you?
Well, we went to 60 American universities in 42 states, and it was debating everywhere, and it was a wonderful opportunity to see the United States. It was just in the Truman period. Roosevelt, of course, died when I was in the Middle East in 1945, and Truman, vice president, became president. And it was the America of the New Deal. And we had very interesting debates. One was, is there a case for an Anglo-American alliance before NATO had been founded? Another one was whether an arts education or a technical education was more important. And we had one funny debate. That was at Oxford, I think, a motion we had in the Union that, in the opinion of this House, the Pilgrim Fathers went too far. That was one we discussed. But it was very, very interesting. And you were there at Princeton. What were you studying then, David?
American politics. I was just growing up in America. I didn't do anything very academic when I was there. But it was the best year educationally of my life. I got much more out of that than I got out of New College, as it happens. But still, you went on. In 1948, you were helping out in an Oxford summer school, and you met Caroline. And instantly proposed to her, and came and went, followed her again to America in 49, and married her and brought her back to England, and set up home and set up a family. And then you got a job with the BBC. Some people say it's the only real job you've ever had, but you were a BBC producer. I remember you producing coverage of Wimbledon back in 1950. But then suddenly, through your old tutor, Tony Crossland, you got nominated, got put forward for nomination in Bristol, and you did this incredible thing of stealing a seat which had been firmly set. Stafford Cripps had retired, Bristol South East was open, there was a by-election coming, and it was to go to Arthur Creech Jones, the defeated colonial secretary. And you went in, and the voter, you remember telling, the vote was, you sat up with a tape recorder all night, when the tape recorder's only gone, rehearsing your speech with Caroline. And then in the selection conference, you got 40 votes, and Creech Jones got 11, and a lady called Mrs. Nicol got 4 votes. And this was just a complete tour de force of some charming, lively, enterprising person just breaking the rules, and you weren't supposed to have this at all. What is your memory of that?
Well, I had been approached during the war by John Parker, who was the Secretary of the Fabian Society, asked if I'd like to stand as a candidate after the war. As I was only 19 at the time, I wrote and said it wasn't possible. And then I was approached again by the Labour Party when I worked for the BBC as a producer, and I couldn't, if I had done it, I'd have lost my job, and I just got married. And then I had been shortlisted for Raymond Blackburn's constituency in Birmingham, you'll remember.
Northfield,
because Raymond Blackburn had suddenly become a Conservative, I think. Sort of quite habit-forming now, as I know. But and then this came up, but it was a by-election, so I was in a different position. But what I didn't realise, of course, they'd had Stafford Cripps for 5 years and they didn't want another cabinet minister. I think it was as simple as that. I don't think I made a particularly brilliant speech, but they knew that if Creech Jones came back, he'd go back in the cabinet. He was a local man born in the constituency, and the national agent came down from London to be sure he got it. And I got elected 54 years ago this year, I think. November the 30th I was elected.
But I remember your description to me of the selection conference when you were asked two questions.
Yeah.
One is, young man, how old is your father? And you said his age, which was 65 or something like that. But then you said, may I tell you a story? And you told a story of your father's going up in planes during the Second World War and other things. He was a good life. And so they weren't going to have another by-election thrust on them immediately. And then you were asked, would you live in the constituency? And you did a splendid piece of demagogy saying that this isn't the... I won't live in the constituency. I'm not a rich man. If you send me to London, you're sending me to represent you in London. I'll come to the constituency as often as you want, but I'm not going to live in the constituency. And this common sense answer I gather, had I heard other people in Bristol tell me, had a very great impact as a realistic thing and not the sycophantic, of course I live in the constituency, which every would-be candidate in every party now says.
Well, I was asked to ask you the two questions were, what money will you give if you're the candidate? And I said, this is not a Tory selection conference, and if I was going to give you any money, I wouldn't tell you now. That was the first one. And the second one, would you live? And I said, I just got married, hoping to have a family, and I want to be at home, but I'll be here whenever you want me. I think the bit about my dad I raised because he was then 73, and when he died, I knew I was in difficulties, so I mentioned that. That didn't affect them.
Now, you got into Parliament, and you got me in to listen to your maiden speech, and which went very well, and everyone was very pleased because they were fond of your father. But then you had to make an impact in the House. What were you to do? And one of the things you did was to form a group with people from all sides of the party, Reggie Paget on the right and Geoffrey Byng on the left, and of course your radical father, to agitate day by day, looking at the order paper and seeing what trouble you could cause to the government. What do you remember of that?
Well, just a wholly false interpretation of my motives. You see, David's got a view of Parliament that it's to govern, and then you judge everybody whether they're potential ministers or not. I was there because I was motivated. I represented my constituency. I voted against the government quite early, actually, when they called up the Zed reservists to go back to war, and I voted against them. I'd been there about 2 months. And the Byng group was set up a year later, when, no, 2 years later, when we were defeated, and it was to examine the order paper every day to see if there were issues we could raise that wouldn't otherwise come up. And I learned a lot from Geoffrey Byng. But this idea your object is that everyone is a would-be Boris Johnson is a complete illusion. And I was asked to join the Bevan group, and I wouldn't join it because I said I'm a new Member of Parliament. I don't want to join a group with a whip of its own when I'm working out how I want to approach things. But it was very helpful to
be in the... But you did then make... become a part of a group called the Keep Calm Group, which was neither Bevanite nor Gaitskellite, and was trying to create peace between the wings. And in fact, you invited me down to stay in the Rowena Hotel at the Margate Conference in 1953, where you were all assembled, a very diverse group, Llewellyn Davis and Tony Greenwood and John Strachey and others. And there you were trying to be a central, stable, sort of moderate thing. It's not the sort of man you know now. But do you remember the Keep Calm?
Well, there never was a Keep Calm group, but we did tried to avoid the party splitting because, you see, in 1951, Nye had resigned over the rearmament programme, which was totally unnecessary. The case for the rearmament programme had never made out. The Russians were not intending to attack us, and we bankrupted the country and lost the election as a result of the rearmament programme. But Nye got the blame. That always happens. And so we were trying to prevent the thing from developing into a permanent split. And I think we loosely called ourselves a Keep Calm group, but there never was one. But I've been a member of it ever since.
In 1952, you bought, I believe, £4,000, Holland Park, 12 Holland Park Avenue, a rather splendid house which you still live in, yeah, and which I have visited so many times, and where you gave such splendid parties over the years. Was that the right thing to do? Was the right place?
Well, first job I had was £9 a week for the BBC, and I had a flat in
Ravenscourt Park.
Ravenscourt Park, where the rent was 100 and Stamford Court. It was actually Goldhawk Road, but it was near Ravenscourt Park. David's always nearly right. And the rent was £115 a year, so I mean, I was living the life of Riley. And then we decided to buy a house. The family was coming along, and this house came up for £4,600 it was, and I couldn't afford it because my pay as an MP was £1,000. So I went to a building site to get a mortgage. They wouldn't give me one, not on an old house. You must be mad. So I had to get a private mortgage from a solicitor, which I paid off, and I've lived there ever since. And it's been my workplace, and Caroline worked there all the time, and so on.
I do remember in this period, in 1952, you were out with Caroline's family in Cincinnati, and I'd been out lecturing in America, and I came and called on you. And then suddenly you got the idea of seeing Adlai Stevenson in his first election campaign, and he said, oh, come and see me. And so we did a mad drive from Cincinnati to Springfield, Illinois, for you to interview Adlai Stevenson. You remember that?
Yes, you didn't come into the interview, did
I didn't
you?
Come to the interview,
but
you
it was an amazing
I made
thing.
Notes of it afterwards. You dictated them, and I wrote them down.
But it was an amazing thing that an American presidential candidate should see a backbench Labour MP in the middle of a campaign. I mean, the idea that he could have found time, but it was very, very interesting. And he said that if he had joined the Vietnam, the beginning of the Korean War, wasn't it? Was it right? Yes, the Korean War.
Yeah.
And he said if he was elected, he would go straight to Korea and try and get a settlement. Of course, he was defeated. But he was a very intelligent man, and I had a lot of time for Adlai Stevenson. And at the end, he was used brutally by Kennedy in some justifying the Bay of Pigs, I think. But it was a very interesting talk, and David very kindly came. It was quite a long drive, wasn't it?
Well, in 1953, you and I were at the wedding of a friend of ours, Peter Blaker, who was a very close friend of both of us at New College, and he later on became a Conservative MP, and you paired with him for 20 years or more.
Never paired with him once, but go on, yes. I don't want to spoil the flow.
You were a pair.
I had paired with people, but never with Peter. But anyway, that's by the by. Yeah. I just don't want your reputation to be untarnished by this discussion.
I will defend that with you afterwards. At this wedding, there was an old buffer giving the wedding speech. It was quite plain that Anthony should have been giving the wedding speech. And you muttered to me, "My dad said to me, whenever you go to any function, always have a clean handkerchief and a speech in your pocket." And I've thought that you always have had a speech in your pocket ever since.
Well, he said it's good practice. It fills in the boredom, and you'd be surprised how often you're asked to say something. That was why he said always think of a speech if you're there. I don't remember the handkerchief, but I do remember that. Always, if you go to any event, have in the back of your mind what would happen if you were asked to speak.
In 1954, you started your agitation to free yourself from the burden of being a peer. And you had to learn a lot of law, and you appeared in the Moses Room at the House of Commons. On the House of Lords, I saw you. And there you were, being, though not a lawyer, a barrister, making a really rather complicated speech which took you back into medieval law in one way or another, in which you were unsuccessful, not altogether surprisingly, but they treated you with great respect because you had got a really serious case to make about the right to renounce a peerage in advance, and your father was obviously supporting you fully in what you did then. What is your memory of that?
Oh, very clear. I mean, I learned a lot of things. First of all, I learned that how important the House of Lords was to the British establishment. Later, when I stood as an elite candidate, after they threw me out, Sir Lionel Heald said, "This campaign is like a boy throwing a brick through a plate glass window." That was the way they saw it. And of course, at that time, you couldn't get into the House of Lords if you weren't hereditary, except for the law lords, and you couldn't get out if you were. Now there's a hole at both ends. You can't get in if you are, and you can't get out. You know, I mean, they've broken both ends. The second thing I learned was you never, ever get justice at the top. That was a very important lesson for me. If you go to the top and ask for justice, they'll always find some reason not to give it to you. It's when you go to people and they support you, and that's why the by-election was the turning point.
Well,
when I went as a disqualified candidate, which I was, and my majority was trebled, then the people at the top said, "We'd better do something about it." So for me, that was quite formative. And what I also learned, very useful things about the present day, because you see, I learned about the House of Lords in the 14th century. When the House of Lords began, there were no hereditary peers, they were all life peers. And this Prime Minister has modernised us back to the 14th century and is a brilliant piece, and modernisation covers the biggest reversion from the hereditary, I'm not that I'm in favour of hereditary, back to the King appointing all the members of the House of Lords. It's a brilliant move, and if I hadn't studied it very carefully, I wouldn't have known it, but I do, and I've used it.
Well, your father did die, alas, in 1960, and I recorded with you about 30 hours of tape about the whole saga. One episode I do remember, when you were describing how ruthlessly Speaker Hilton Foster had treated you afterwards, and I said something, "What a total shit," and you said, "You mustn't say that," and I said, "But really, why shouldn't I say it? And he's not God," and you said, "Ah, but the Speaker is God. We bow before him every time we go in." I was rebuked and found that I was next to a real arch-conservative at that particular moment.
Well, I'm not in favour of abusing people, and maybe that was it, but Hilton Foster said, when I was re-elected and turned up again as the new MP for Bristol South East, I went to the doorkeeper, Victor Stockley, and I said, "I'm turning up on Monday," and he said, "You can't come in," and I said, "On whose instructions?" And he said, "The Speaker's," and I said, "Has the Speaker given you instructions to keep me out by force?" And he said, "Yes." So when that happened, I didn't make an issue of it. But I had been to see Hilton Foster beforehand, and he told me he was going to do that. But it was an extraordinary thing to be re-elected and told you couldn't sit because your blood had turned blue. I mean, you can imagine anything more ludicrous. But that was the argument.
But also, your standing again caused some unpopularity in the party. You were thought to be selfish, and Gaitskell gave you no support at all, and then very belatedly saw that it was a popular cause, and it worked, as it were, as a good piece of radical activity.
Well, that's exactly what I was saying, that you never get any support at the top, and when they discover that the people support you, then they change their mind. I mean, progress. You begin with an idea like votes for women, and it's ignored. Then if you go on, you're mad. Then if you go on, you're dangerous. Then there's a pause. Then you can't find anyone at the top who doesn't claim to have thought of it in the first place. That is how progress is made. And my life has... I've learned that from the peerage case and applied it ever since. But it is true. Mind you, I was re-selected for Bristol, so you can't say the Labour Party tried to keep me out. But Gaitskell then, when I was thrown out the second time... Well, he wouldn't come and speak for me. He said, party leaders never go to by-elections. So I was, he didn't help me then. And then he said to me, why don't you try and persuade your wife to stand? It was a ludicrous idea. She was an American and would have died rather than take British citizenship. And anyway, the whole idea of you sort of fiddle the Constitution without dodging the real question.
But there is one of the areas where you had greatest influence on British political history. Because of your agitation, the Conservatives were ashamed into passing the Renunciation of Peerages Act. And you were the first person to take advantage of that in August the 1st, 1963. But that opened the door, by chance, opened the door for Alec Douglas-Hume to become Prime Minister and changed the history of the Conservative Party by the mere fact that there was this 12-month door in which hereditary peers like Hailsham and Hume could renounce their peerage.
Well, it's true, you see. The funny thing is the Commons, when they passed the peerage bill, said it will only apply in future cases to keep me out. And when it went to the Lords, they amended it to include sitting peers. I think maybe because they had Hume in mind. But anyway, that was a consequence of it. But what I learned from it was so important. Never expect justice from the top. And now, that really is something that, on a whole range of other issues, has influenced me enormously.
Now, while you were involved in that, in 1960-61, the Labour Party was tearing itself apart, for as it so often tries to, but Gaitskell's speech at Scarborough, Fight and Fight Again. And at that moment, you resigned from the National Executive in order to make a point. You were trying, I think, another version of the Keep Calm group. I'm trying to produce sanity in the party, where there were people who were rather extremely violent on each side.
Well, at the time, I took the view, which is now very common, that weapons of mass destruction are too dangerous. And I will now reinterpret the Gaitskell speech. I will fight and fight and fight again to see if we keep weapons of mass destruction. And I thought that was wrong. And I still think that's wrong. And it was an extraordinary thing to say, particularly as now we don't have any nuclear weapons. The Americans lend them to us, and if we tried to fire the button, press the button, they'd go up and come down again unless the Americans switched on their global satellite system. So actually, we've had election after election about whether we should retain what we don't have. And it's extraordinary. It's only the capacity of political correspondence keeps you in the dark about such an important matter. And at that time, I thought it was wrong to have them, and I resigned. And later, I resigned in the front bench because I was the air spokesman. I resigned on the same as years ahead of CND.
Now, at that time, the world changed. The Conservatives were falling into trouble, and Labour looked like winning, and Gaitskell died, and Wilson was there. And you are said to be the source of the phrase, the white heat of the technological revolution. And you got involved in quite a lot of what the Labour Party was trying to do when they took office in 1964.
Now, my wife Caroline invented the title The New Britain Manifesto, and the white heat was Harold's, but it was totally misunderstood. People thought he meant, I'm going to put on a white coat and go around with a blow lamp and modernize the economy. What he actually was saying was this: we will all be burned up by technological unemployment in the white heat of the technological revolution unless we plan. So it was actually a restatement of socialism in 1964 by Harold. And then, of course, I got three industrial jobs in a row, which gave me an opportunity to try and cope with what has turned out to be the biggest problem of all, the massive deindustrialization of Britain. So we're now a third world country with a bomber queen and a tourist trade. And that was what he meant by that. And I had the job of trying to prevent British industry from being just disappearing down the plug hole.
Well, could you say something then about your first administrative job, which you were Postmaster General in 1964, and you were there when postcodes were coming in and the electronic telephone exchanges were just coming in. Was this exciting? Were you actually sort of involved in real decisions on big issues?
Well, I mean, those were technical matters. But the post office at that time had a tremendous importance because the computer revolution was coming, and I set up a thing called the National Data Processing Service, under which the post office would be able to transmit material, and then also set up the gyro so that there was a local bank facility in every post office. That was more important than the postal code, though I did approve the ones that came in, and I was also involved in the long-distance dialing. But it was an important job, and of course now the present government is trying to privatise the post office on a massive scale. And so I have a deep commitment to the public service there, and I feel it very, very strongly now that they're trying to destroy it.
Well, in July 66, Frank Cousins suddenly resigned, and you were promoted to the Cabinet as Minister of Technology. And I remember asking you at the time, how much difference does it make being in the Cabinet rather than a senior minister outside the Cabinet? And you said it makes a lot of difference. One, you don't stand around outside the Cabinet waiting to be called in for your item, and you've got a sense that if you're a politician, you have a sense of the mood of a committee, and you're there discussing other items before you're speaking, so you can talk better there. But two, also you see all the papers, and it does give you a different authority. I wanted just to press you a little bit more about your general view of Cabinet government as you saw it, where you were learnt about it in 66 to 70.
Well, I was a Minister of Cabinet rank from 64, but I was only put in the Cabinet in 66. And of course, it's interesting to look at it now because Cabinet government has disappeared. The Prime Minister has the Cabinet for 20 minutes if he hasn't got a photo opportunity to tell them what he's decided. And when I was in the Cabinet, and it was full of brilliant people, Roy Jenkins, Gerald Gardner, Dick Crossman, Barbara Castle, you know, formidable people. I looked in my diary, and in January 68, we had 8 full-day meetings of the Cabinet, morning and afternoon, in a single month. And it was a real collective, and it was the most exciting committee I've ever worked in because of the quality of the people and the magnitude of the issues. And sometimes you won and sometimes you lost. I mean, Harold Wilson was outvoted on one occasion. Can't imagine that now. And the loss of Cabinet government explains, in my opinion, the alienation of Parliament and the people from what the government is now, what the Prime Minister is now doing. So I feel very strongly about the Cabinet. And my diary, I mean, I looked at the uncut diary the other day. I've got 8,000 words on a single day in 1976, describing simply in detail a Cabinet meeting. And I found them really, really interesting. So it wasn't just not wanting to hang about outside. It was you were participating in very, very big decisions like the IMF cuts or the Vietnam War or whatever it happened to be.
Now, I remember back in the 1940s, your father saying to me, "My boy, you must understand that in politics, there can be no friendship at the top." Now, in the 1960s, I called quite often on my way back from London at Holland Park Avenue and had a drink with you or a cup of coffee with you. And I remember 2 or 3 times then, the phone rang and you had a conversation with Peter Shaw as a friend, an intimate cabinet minister. And you talked, I didn't know, you couldn't get the references, but there was an intimate conversation about the events during the day that you had with a fellow cabinet minister, which was obviously one of close friendship. And afterwards, I used this occasionally without any attribution of where I'd heard it, but saying that it's not true, there can be no friendship at the top. And I repeated this to you perhaps 20 years later, and you said, "Oh no, my dad was right. Peter and I disagreed on one big issue. Once we both wanted the same job, we're still good friends." And I noticed that he was almost the only politician at Caroline's funeral. But there is Peter. The rock of politics got between you. How far is this a fair picture?
I think you're in a muddle, David, honestly. I don't know quite how to come to terms with it. The rows in the Labour Party are family rows, if you know what I mean. You have a flaming row and then you're in good terms. I mean, Dennis Healey, for example, he and I are very good mates. He came to speak for me in Chesterfield after I stood against him in the deputy leadership. Jim Callaghan rang me up when Caroline was dying and said, "I'm thinking of you and your carer." I went to his 90th birthday at number 10. family rather, but of course when you disagree with somebody, you disagree very strongly. Just before Roy Jenkins died, about a week before he died, he wrote and said, "I've really enjoyed your diaries. I couldn't put them down, and I agreed with much more than you'd expect." So I rang him up, and he was ill, and I know he died 2 days later. So I don't think it's true. What's meant by friends at the top is that you can't rely on a personal friendship to overcome political differences. But I think people misunderstood the rows in the Labour Party, really. They were violent rows about issues, but they didn't necessarily affect personal relations. At least that was my experience.
Could we move on to the point where, apart from the opening the door for Alec Douglas Hume, you most obviously changed the British Constitution. You were the person who started talking about a referendum to solve the problem of Europe in 1970, and Jim Callaghan said, voted against it, but said, this is a lifeboat, a rubber life raft in which we may all have to scramble. And there it was. So you are, I think, the father of the British referendum, though I don't think you're all that keen on referendums. I've tried to get you involved in discussions about them since, and you've said, well, you know, you've slightly shrugged your shoulders.
No, I mean, a referendum on constitutional matters is absolutely essential. You can't hand over the powers of the electors to somebody else without their consent. But a referendum on hanging or whatever, I've never been in favour of. But what got it in 1970, we won it in 72, I think, the European Communities Act was January 72, and then we had the debate. And it was when Pompidou persuaded the French Parliament to have a referendum as to whether to admit Britain. And that was so embarrassing that Wilson capitulated, and then Roy Jenkins resigned as deputy leader. The thought that the public might be consulted about a matter of importance was too much for Roy, so he gave up the deputy leadership. If he hadn't given it up, he'd have been Prime Minister, but that's another story. Now, amazing, that.
Can I then ask you in a moment, I want to preface it, about your transition in between 1967 or so and 1973 from being not particularly conspicuously a left-wing member of the Labour Party to being the sort of symbol of the left. But there was one particular thing which has amused the outside world a bit. It's maybe trivial. But I did do some work this week on your Who's Who entry. And up to 1971, your Who's Who entry is absolutely conventional one. Westminster, New College, and all the rest of it, and the family connections, and your publications, and your membership of the Commons. And then suddenly Westminster disappeared 1 year. And the next year, Oxford disappeared. And you actually then put in education still in progress, which I thought was rather charming. And then the entry disappeared completely, and in 1977 there was no entry in Who's Who for entry. But in 1978 there was a two-line entry, obviously written in the office, which merely says Member of Parliament for Bristol South East, address House of Commons. And then suddenly you creep back, but you have no education left after 1980, when most of the rest of your family and publications come back in it. Is there a story to your Who's Who entry?
Well, what's interesting to me is when I took it out, it made them so angry. It was like giving up a peerage. And anyone who thinks I'm trying to conceal my childhood, I've written a book about my public school, my private school, my domestic life. So if you think I'm trying to conceal my past, but it did make them very angry. And I just felt that it wasn't for them to decide. And then they did, they put me back themselves, adjust my address. But it was a very minor matter. You see, I was radicalized by being a minister. That's a thing that nobody seems to understand. If you sit in Whitehall, you realize that just being anti-Tory gets you nowhere. You have to understand where power lies. And what I learned as a minister was the power of multinational corporations, the power of the media, the power of all sorts of the banks and all that, and it radicalized me. And when I published a book of my speeches called Arguments for Socialism, Mackenzie, your mate, interviewed me when the book was published. He said, "Well, why didn't you say this when you were in office?" I said, "Look it up. They were all speeches made when I was in office." And that's what radicalized me. And I mean, when I said education still in progress, it's still true. I mean, to sit in cabinet and hear, you know, the IMF telling you to cut hundreds of millions off your balance off your public expenditure, or they'll destroy your currency. My God, if that doesn't teach you a thing or two. Or to see what the Daily Mail can do to you, or the Sun can do to you. To have journalists in the street, in the garden all night, banging at the door and and to have your rubbish collected in a Rover car every morning. Now, I know the Kensington Borough Council is conservative and very efficient, but, I mean, when you've experienced what the assassins in Fleet Street do to you, it does strengthen your determination. As Danai said, if you... it isn't worth doing... What did I forget what he said. It isn't worth doing unless you believe in it. And I feel that very strongly. I mean, I've been through that. I don't want to go through it again, but I've learned the lesson. And you can't make sense of British politics unless you understand now where power really rests. And it doesn't rest in number 10 or anywhere. It rests elsewhere.
Anthony, in 10 minutes or so, I want to throw the last half hour open to the audience. But I think we must just press a little bit further on the question of your radicalisation. The image of you as the man who, in many ways, wrecked the Labour Party, kept it out of power for all those years. You're very familiar with all the innuendos. And I must say, what you've just said, that I've had this extraordinary sense of having been a friend of yours and being known to be a friend of yours, of the incredible nonsense said about you and about you and your values and so on. I don't agree with almost anything you say, but I do actually strongly approve of you as a human being, and therefore I want to pay tribute to that. But just explain to me...
Nice. Don't overdo it, David, just to please the audience.
But that's explain to me about your answer to the question that you made the Labour Party unelectable.
Well, I mean, more than that, I got Mrs. Thatcher elected single-handed, and I kept her in office. I mean, I'm the most powerful man in British politics. I mean, the truth is that all this journalist stuff about it, why did we lose in 83? Well, one reason was 10% of the Labour MPs, including two of their deputy leaders, left the party, and with the full support of the BBC and the media, tried to destroy the Labour Party. That's never mentioned. I mean, they don't mention the fact that George Brown and Roy Jenkins tried to destroy the Labour Party. Oh, that's forgotten. No, it was just because I didn't want a militant expelled. And, you know, we expelled a guy called Tommy Sheridan because his policies were unelectable. He's got six MSPs in Scotland now. And what I've discovered, and I'm going around, you know, giving these lectures, for the first time in my life, public opinion is well to the left of what's called a Labour government. Nobody wants pensioners in poverty, nobody wants students saddled with debt, nobody wants privatisation, and nobody wants another bloody war. And so this idea that it was hard left, it was common sense against a time when New Labour was actually coming into being under Kinnock, and it was basically a sort of pre-Thatcherite in 81. No, Thatcherite, Thatcher was already there. And trouble about Neil was he gave up everything he ever believed in. And in the end, nobody believed a word he said about anything. And there is a case for a degree of consistency in politics, even if you're wrong. And I don't feel that that was true. I mean, I suffered from all that jargon, but looking back on it, I don't believe there's a word of truth in it.
Anthony, I've seen you, been visiting you in your constituency in every election, almost every election, I think, of the 18 that you have fought during the election. And I've talked to you in Holland Park Avenue just before elections. And time and again, I've been slightly humiliated by your eloquence about what is going on in the British public. Even when I thought it was quite different, and I've been perhaps unduly influenced by opinion polls and the like. But you have, because you're such a wonderful orator, have seen the shining eyes of huge audiences, and I've only talked to a few people travelling around the country and read these partisan newspapers. And I've sort of known that you were wrong, but you have known that you were right because of the power of your own eloquence and the fact that people do... are convinced by you while you're saying these things. Do you worry about a certain thing which people talk about, it's an embarrassing word to use, charisma, about whether you falsify your own perceptions of what's happening because you can do this thing when you're on the platform?
Well, I mean, it's a total misunderstanding. After the peace demonstration last year, 1903, somebody at the BBC said to me, "You're a voice in the wilderness." I said, "Well, there are 2 million people in my wilderness. How many are there in yours?" And the whole purpose of the media is to discourage, to make people feel it's not worth it, you're unrepresentative, and so on. Actually, you say what you think. And if people listen to it and agree with you, then you win. If they don't agree with you, you lose. But this idea, I don't believe in charisma, because the most successful political leader in my lifetime, Clem Attlee, had no charisma at all. He was short, bald as a coot, had a little moustache, looked like Charlie Chaplin, and beat Winston Churchill, who'd won the war single-handed with a big cigar in a bomb shelter.
I remember when...
And so I don't believe in charisma, and I think it's a load of rubbish. But I do think that politicians who can't address audiences are frightened of addressing audiences. You know, the Labour Conference, the only conference in Britain where they search you not for bombs, but for socialist literature. If you have any socialist literature, you can't get into the conference. Now, there's something wrong when the communication between the... top and the bottom, if that's what it is so corrupted by spin doctors. Anyway, you're stirring me up, which I know what you wanted to do, and I'm trying to meet
you. When you mentioned, actually, I couldn't help remembering one of your best remarks. somebody said at the Rowena Hotel 953, isn't it terrible, we're led by a man who is like a stopped clock. And you said, ah, but a stopped clock is dead right once every 24 hours.
Well, Nye once said about Attlee in the lavatory at number 10, he said he's got the democracy of the mind. For him, any one idea is as good as any other, which I thought was a very sharp comment, and wasn't true anyway, because Clem was a brilliant leader.
Let me ask you, you may be thinking up questions, let me ask you one last sort of question. Decline, in a way, you got thrown off the National Executive in 1993, you had been there as an absolute star figure for 40 years. And what has it been like? You and I know about retirement, and it has its snags and it has its bonuses. But what about the sort of the view of the final phase?
Well, I define retirement in the legal way. I've sat in the High Court of Parliament as a jury for 51 years, and I've retired to give my verdict. That is, when a jury retires, that's when they start work. And I'm starting work. I've never worked so hard in my life. I don't want anything from anybody. I don't want promotion. I don't need cash. I don't want anything. And I'm going round in what I believe is the highest level in politics when you're a teacher. I'm not a qualified teacher. I'm an untrained classroom assistant to the nation. And I go round explaining what I think is happening and encouraging people, because the one thing old men who talk about the past are boring, old men who whinge about the present are intolerable, old men who try and run anything are bloody menace. The purpose of the old is to encourage people, and the media and the establishment's whole purpose is to discourage you. Just believe Paxman and Humphreys, and don't ever think for yourself. And it's really frightening. And so that's what I'm doing. And funny enough, people come. Whether it's my charisma, I'll have to try again. But I have a sort of feeling that the British political class totally underestimate the intelligence of people in Britain. They think we're a lot of nitwits, so the government can do what it likes and the media can dumb things down. But actually, the level of intelligence and understanding is at a far higher level. And I'm enjoying life. I wouldn't go back to Parliament now, even if a seat was offered to me.
Now, we've got about nearly half an hour left, and I'm just looking around for eyes. Michael Lyle.
I'm also going to indulge in a certain bit of reminiscence. You mentioned, David,
Michael Lyle was a clerk in the House of Commons for 40 years and knows, has experienced the tiresomeness of Tony Benn in many ways.
Oh, never. It was great fun every time we met. But the first meeting I was going to talk about was in 1951, not in 1970, as you said, when a young Mr. Benn came and saw an even younger Michael Lyle, and said he wanted to bring in a bill for a referendum on British membership of the European communities. And indeed, Tony, you indicated at that stage, I believe, a certain sympathy with the idea of British membership. On that you may not have been consistent, but on your desire for referendum, absolutely. So I looked at this as a rather unusual proposal, and I got out my Erskine May and scanned through the footnotes and found an old precedent, and it gave something I'm really absolutely ashamed I ever did. I advised you that it was unconstitutional to have a referendum, and therefore a private member could not bring in a bill to have a referendum. And you took it very meekly and went away, and you deferred your pressure for the referendum until 1970. So I was quite intrigued by this early encounter. What I'd like to ask, if I can, much more serious, is would you like to comment a little bit on the House of Commons as an institution today and how effective it is? Is it diminishing, as some people say, or is it, I believe, much more strong and much more effective than it used to be?
Well, on the question of the clerks, my father said to me when I was elected, make friends with the clerks, he said, because if you understand procedure, you'll get greater opportunities any other way. And I went and had tea with the clerk of the house when I had fellows, it was. You'll remember him very well. And it was like having tea with the headmaster. And then when I had my peerage battle, I went to the House of to the clerks, and they helped me draft a bill that would permit the renunciation of peerages. And I've actually introduced about 25 private bills, private members' bills, not one of which has ever been debated, but one day I'm going to publish them all. They're quite interesting, because many of them are now law, of course, including the peerage one and gay rights and freedom of information. It's quite interesting. But I think the House of Commons now is weaker than I've ever known it. I don't look back on the glory days, but I do remember in the old days, I asked Churchill a question about Britain's nuclear relations with America, and he answered it. Can't ask the Prime Minister anything now except, what is you doing today, which everybody knows, and will you visit my constituents, if everybody knows he won't do. And so he doesn't know what the real question is. And I think the power of patronage and the decline of the vitality of the Labour Party because of the way politics has become so centralised has weakened the House very, very much. I mean, put quite crudely, I think we've got to have the battle, the Chartists have got to start again. And I feel very, cabinet government is gone, it's all now centrally run, and there are all these advisers now in Whitehall, neither elected nor with the talent and test of a civil servant. And I think it's a very, very decaying system myself. But I'm not saying there aren't good speeches made, but I'm very discouraged by it all. And of course, real power rests anywhere else doesn't rest there. Prime Minister can't disagree with America. Gordon Brown can't spend more than 3% of his GDP without breaking the Maastricht Treaty Stability Pact and be taken to the court by the Commission. I think democracy is in a very, very fragile state at the moment in Britain, and I think it'll have to be started again.
There and then there.
Hello, I just want to ask a question about the Constitution. For my sins, I'm the chairman of the Conservative Party in Gibraltar. I've come a long way for this debate. In Gibraltar, we're quite radical, actually, and our views on the Constitution, I suspect, are very close to yours, Tony. Most of us are Republicans. And I was at the Brighton conference recently, and I was pleasantly surprised how far the Conservative Party have moved towards House of Lords reform. If I understand it correctly, they want to, they use the expression almost wholly elected, which appears to be about 99% elected. They're still insisting on bishops sitting there, I don't know why. And I just think it's ironic that we may be approaching the next election where the Conservatives have a policy on House of Lords reform which is more radical than Labour. I just wonder what your views on that are.
Well, the reason the House of Lords survives is because it is the source of prime ministerial patronage. If you're a prime minister as a difficult editor, you make him a peer. That's why they call them press lords. If you want to create a vacancy in the Commons, you make an old MP a peer and parachute in your best friend into the by-election. And it's tremendously powerful. And the prime minister is passionately opposed to an elected House. But if you're going to take constitutional reform seriously, the Scottish Parliament, Welsh Assembly, English Parliament, and a small elected Senate. And so I think I'd be very surprised if the Tories come out with a radical proposal, because if Howard's Prime Minister, he'll need all that power too, even more. So I think that the battle to make the House of Lords or the second chamber democratic might take as long as it took to get the House of Commons, which was about 700 or 800 years.
A question here.
As someone who has lived through most of the events you mentioned as a student and later as a political refugee, I came. I would like to make a short comment and ask for your response. It has been said in the 80s that the Labour Party was unelectable. If you look at the Labour Party from the 1990s onwards, you are led to the tragic conclusion that it became electable at the expense of being unrecognizable.
Well, I think insofar as I understand New Labour, I think what they said was, exactly as you say, Thatcherism has established a dominant position. If you want to win, you've got to adopt it. And of course, the British establishment couldn't believe its luck, because if you're going to have right-wing policies, who better to run it than a leader of the Labour Party who's got the loyalty of the party? And when Mrs. Thatcher was asked her greatest achievement, she said New Labour. And she's absolutely right. And Howard hasn't a dog's chance, because you have the best Conservative Prime Minister we've ever had from their point of view. Trouble is, it wasn't just unrecognisable, it wasn't anything to do, as you say, with the Labour Party. But public opinion, as I say, I think is so far ahead now that at some stage the thing will come right. But it is quite extraordinary. And the first person I think the Prime Minister saw when he became Prime Minister called in Mrs. Thatcher. And I mean, that's so obvious. When I said it to begin with years ago, it was considered very unhelpful. But now everybody says it's so boring because everybody knows it's true. We could have won in 87. If we'd supported the miners, if the Kinnock had supported the miners and the TUC and the miners had won, which they would have done, Thatcher would have been out in 87 instead of 97. That would have made us a bit electable.
I can imagine having a very long argument for you on that the interpretation of hypothetical history. But there's a question here in the front, then I'm going to ask George Jones afterwards.
Hello, I'm a member of the public. I have three unrelated questions. I hope that doesn't mean I hog too much of the next few minutes. All right. Well, the first one is, what do you think of the proposed smoking ban? And secondly... right. Maybe I can go on to my other two. Is that one being answered? I was here last night and Nigel Lawson was talking about his period as Chancellor and said manufacturing didn't matter. Be interested in your thoughts on that. And finally, is there anybody in the Tory party, do you think, could lead that party to a general election victory, given what a lot of us think about the current leader of the Labour Party?
Well, I try not to be personal. I'm asked about Labour leader and so on. I don't know. The Tory party may come back in some shape or form. On smoking, I've never smoked if people objected, but I think the persecution of people who want to have a puff is a bit much. But as I say, I always ask permission, and if people say no, I respect it. I think the loss of manufacturing industry is incredible. In 1948, we launched 48% of all the ships launched in the world. In 1970, we had the biggest motorbike industry in the world, bigger than Germany, Japan, or the United States. In 1974, we had the biggest machine tool company and the biggest motor car company in Europe. Now we haven't any of it. We've thrown the whole lot away. And we have museums showing what we used to make. And we are a third world country now. And China is booming at a huge rate. And we've lost it. And when you lose it because it's cheaper from abroad, if when you've closed down your industry, they can charge what they like. We don't close down farms because there's cheaper butter 1 year from New Zealand. And we should have protected our manufacturing industry. And you see Dyson, who made that lovely vacuum cleaner without a bag, 800 people employed, closes the factory, sacks them all, opens it in Malaysia where the wages are a third of what they are, trebles its profit, and then the 800 people say, we're unemployed because of migrants and join the National Front. I mean, you've got to be serious about the consequences of this. So I think that our efforts to save British manufacture were absolutely justified, and I think we'll rue the day. And look at the mines. They've closed the pits, and there's 1,000 years of coal under our territory, no miners, and we're having wars about energy. You see, all these radical far-left ideas that David so disapproved of turned out to be absolutely right. And that is something that's not, I'm not using my charisma on you, I'm just putting a point of view.
But let me just put that to you simply. You were Minister of Technology in 1974-5,
yep.
And you did some very enterprising efforts to make industry work, and a newspaper in Scotland and so on. Looking back on that, do you have any regrets?
Oh, I made a million mistakes in my life. They're all in my diaries. I'm not... The only thing I would be ashamed of, but if I ever thought I'd said anything I didn't believe, to get on, and I don't think I ever did. But I made a million mistakes, of course. But we could have saved manufacturing industry. We should have saved it. And we didn't. And we're paying a very, very heavy price. And so are the Americans. I mean, they've lost, what is it, 500,000 jobs this year. And they're going to realize what's happened to them. So I don't regret that. But of course, the government at the time didn't really believe in what we were doing. They called it Bennism or something. And now, there is no Department of Industry. There is no industrial policy in Britain at the moment. If there's a closure, what's her name, Patricia Hewitt, washes her hands and says it's business decision-making. And I think people wake up to that and realize what a tragedy it was.
Professor George Jones.
Could you tell us why you never became the leader of the Labour Party? Was there something that made your colleagues uneasy about you?
Well, I didn't become leader because I wasn't elected. I mean, I don't want to make a basic democratic point to such a distinguished academic, but if you don't win enough votes, you don't become leader. You'll have to excuse me. I did try four times. I stood for the deputy leadership twice, the leadership twice. But what I would never do is to say what I didn't believe to get in. I said what I believed, and if they didn't want it, they didn't want it. The deputy leadership was funny because Healy got in with the support of a lot of people who a week later joined the SDP. So if they joined a week early, I would have been deputy leader, but I'd have no regret about that.
50.75 to 49.25.
Yes, but I mean, his majority of 0.1 was based on people who left to join the SDP after they'd got him safely there. But anyway, I've never seen politics as being about how far you climb up the greasy pole. I would just like to believe, and I do, that when I said it, I believed it, even if it was wrong, which it often was, on nuclear power. It was absolutely wrong. Nuclear, I supported it, and it's a complete disaster, and so that's... But that, nothing wrong with being wrong. What's wrong is saying what you don't believe. I divide people into weathercocks and signposts. I'd rather be a signpost. You don't have to follow the advice they give. It'll come back in 5 years and the signpost is there and the weathercock hasn't got an opinion until he's read the polls and the focus groups. I've no time for signposts and Parliament's full of them.
A question over here.
Yes. Sorry. Okay. Mr. Van, you talked a lot about the establishment. After lecturing here a few times, is LSE part of the establishment?
Is what?
LSE part of the establishment?
Well, I do remember, this will make you laugh, because the old LSE was so radical. And I came once, now who on earth was it? It was some Tory MP, it was Christopher Soames, I think. And we drove to the LSE and he said, is this an educational institution? And I thought, God, if the LSE has so ceased to frighten the establishment. But, you know, I don't know, though it's a funny word, the establishment, but there is a sort of coalition of the political class, the media and the academics, who all see Parliament as an instrument for governing people. Whereas people on the whole see Parliament as a way of getting something done. And I think Parliament as a diffusing mechanism to defuse difficulty is very dangerous. Parliament as an instrument for progress is something that excites me. And I think there's a bit too much of the defusing now. You know, just concede enough, put a few communist trade unionists in the House of Lords and all the trouble will go away. It's a very clever mechanism. It wouldn't have lasted so long if it was really quite as radical as I would like to think it should be.
Gentlemen over there.
Yes, I don't want to keep returning to the manufacturing question, but it is noticeable, I think, that although there was obviously tremendous disruption and hardship as we essentially moved out of manufacturing, that this was not unique to Britain. It's happened and is still happening across the Western world, and that if you look at Britain today, we're actually a wealthier society as a whole than we were with our manufacturing base, and we probably have a lower unemployment than we did then.
Well, gambling makes you much richer, you know. Why bother to make work in a factory when you can make money in the City of London? I mean, they don't call it gambling, but gambling can be wildly successful. And that's what it is. People making money by gambling with wealth that other people have created. I don't want to sound too radical, because I don't want to frighten David. He's just beginning to be friendly. But, I mean, I am a socialist. You know, I really don't think that is the way things go. And, of course, the superpowers of tomorrow, China, are building up their manufacture.
Lady over here.
The last person connected to the Labour Party that I heard speak was Alistair Campbell. And you might be surprised to hear that he shares some of your views on the media. I wonder if the media aren't doing their job in commenting on politics properly, and as public trust in politicians is undermined, how you suggest that politicians can connect with the electorate?
Well, I don't share Alistair Campbell's view of the media. He objects to them because they don't print everything he wants them to say. That's not my view at all. My view is that political coverage in the BBC now, you have Andrew Neil at the Labour conference, and he goes over to Daisy Sampson, who interviews another journalist about what the Prime Minister will probably mean this afternoon when he makes a speech he hasn't heard, and no delegates are ever heard. You never hear a delegate. And Prime Minister's questions is just an exchange of abuse between the Leader of the Opposition and the Prime Minister, and then loyal backbenchers who don't ask a question at all. Can I trouble my right honourable friend to remind us of his latest triumph since last Wednesday? And somebody said, there are so many planted questions, it ought to be called gardener's question time. But you never hear anybody speak. I mean, there's no equivalent on the BBC of the column. The theory is that the attention span is 15 seconds or 2 minutes or something, and I find, going round, it's just astonishing, the contribution, just listening to people. And so I think my complaint about the media is that they dominate the discussion and exclude people with really interesting ideas. I mean, you know, when I would think there should be a Dimbleby lecture every day, only not quite as long, where you let people talk. That's my objection to the media. I don't mind being attacked by the media. I mean, I'm beyond that now anyway. But I do want to be able to hear people, and I can't. I imagined the other day how Moses would have got on if he'd come down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments and tried to explain it on Newsnight. I mean, just think, he'd have never got through the first commandment, thou shalt honour thy mother and father, Patrick, you don't live in the real world, and you'd have never heard them. You must hear an argument before you cross-examine. But Campbell's view was, you've got to take orders, otherwise I won't put up with you, and that's very different. That's not my view at all.
There are no microphones in the gallery, so if anybody in the gallery wants to...
Oh, there is one.
There's a mic. Oh, thank you. Well, I haven't caught any eyes. I was despairing on finding it. There's a question down here, though. Gentleman here. There, yes.
Oh, there will be one, I hope.
Yeah. A celestial question.
Can I...
prepare. Let me have one. Yeah, okay.
Yes, could I take up a historical point, which I think might have been slightly skated over. The two periods you referred to when there were really perhaps the most polarised divisions in the Labour Party were the 1950s and the 1980s. And it seems you played a very different role in those. One, you were trying to keep people calm and bring them together. And whatever you might say, in the 1980s, you were very much associated with one side and to fight for that side, and that side coalesced around you. Do you think that's because the actual nature of those conflicts and those divisions were very different in those times, or was it just you who had changed because of your experiences as a minister and so on?
Well, I've never been in favour of abusive conversation, but I mean, you say I divided people. I stood for the deputy leadership. I mean, is standing in an election divisive? I mean, you know, this whole idea that if you have an election and you stand, that is divisive. Actually, elections are about alternative candidates. I mean, if the media covered Parliament the way it covers the Labour Party, they'd say, the Parliament was split again tonight. 295 voted for the hunting bill. You see the language you use. And I was never part of the militant tendency, but I didn't want people to be expelled for political reasons, because my predecessor, Cripps, was expelled from the Labour Party. So was an Aaron Bevan. So was Jim Mortimer. And I'm opposed to expulsion for political reasons. And that made me into a sort of far left, but that was what the media could do. I'm not complaining, it's their job and they sell newspapers, but they can't blame me if I understand what they're doing, and it is quite tricky.
A lady down the front in the gallery. The mic in the gallery.
Sorry. Oh good, she's got it.
I've got a quick question. I was wondering if you could comment on the election in the United States and the disparate way that votes are actually collected from the people there.
Well, I thought just before, the day before the election, the Democrats might win with the higher turnout and, you know, poor blacks and the Democratic blacks and whites might vote. I underestimated the evangelicals, who regard life as so sacred you can't have an abortion, but you can kill 100,000 Iraqis. That's their view of religion. And it's a terrifying one, and we've got to think very hard. For the first time in my life, when I heard the evangelicals, I understood what Marx meant when he said religion is the opium of the people. Because that sort of religion is the opium of the people. Whereas, you know, the real religious teaching about love thy neighbour and so on is not. So, but I was very disappointed. I gave David a list of the votes in 18 wards in Ohio, where in every case the votes cast exceeded the number of people on the register. I thought, as he is a cephologist, that would be a few pebbles I could drop into his mind.
We've got to end in a moment or two. I've put two people on the floor here, and then I'm going to ask Richard Holm to ask the last question.
I was interested to hear you talking about your early experience in politics. I first started distributing literature at the age of 7 in the 1945 election. However, recently, in the last general election, fewer people between the ages of 18 and 25 voted in that election compared to voting in Big Brother. How can we make certain that younger people are engaged before we do actually have a political Big Brother?
Well, I don't believe there's any apathy at all. I think most people, or many people in Britain, are absolutely furious that no one listens to them and don't believe a bloody word they're told by government. And anger and mistrust are intensely political, but they're not connected to the parliamentary system, and that is worrying. But I don't think, I've never met anyone who says, I don't care when you go to war with Iraq, I don't care whether students are saddled with debt, I don't care what old people. No, it's quite a different reaction. And I think, I've always regarded the Labour Party as the link that linked the street to the statute book, the demonstration to Downing Street. You know, you take the feeling and you do something about it. And that link has been broken by the neo-Thatcherism of New Labour. And I think that is a serious problem, and it worries me very much. And when we're in the European Union, even more fully with the Constitution, if we have a referendum and it goes that way, and people realise whoever you vote for, you can't change the laws you're expected to obey, we'll either go back to rioting or we'll have mass abstention, and both ways would be deadly to parliamentary democracy, because I am a believer in it. I mean, I served all those years because I believed in it, but I think it's now being eroded quite substantially, and it really worries me.
A penultimate question from there.
Yeah, I just caught a headline, I think it was in the Times today, partly Chirac saying that the UK can't act as a broker between the US and Europe. I was just wondering if you thought that it was necessary for the UK, Tony Blair, to keep getting involved and actually just let the American administration act as a grown-up and go over there themselves.
Well, I mean, this idea that Blair is a bridge across the Atlantic is nonsense. I mean, on the key question of the Iraq War, Chirac and Schroeder were against, and he was uncritically in favour. But he is the Vice President of the United States, in effect, a job I would think would be happy to let him have. I think it would be appropriate. But it isn't. This idea that you can just do everything you're told by Washington is nonsense. And funnily enough, although I don't want to be personal, Bush is very unpopular in Britain. You know, he said that God wanted him to be president. That's enough to make anyone an atheist. And I think religious war is a deadly thing, and Bush and Blair have launched religious war where God's on both sides. And that really, really frightening. That'll last for centuries. And so we've got to be careful about that. But I don't believe that this is the bridge at all.
Richard, will you ask a final question and then stay up at the podium and say the thank yous for me?
Oh, goodness. Oh, come on. Right. I thought you were going to ask a question when you were handed the mic.
You can ask the question now.
The question I want to ask is purely rhetorical and very personal, which is how, for those of us who are beginning to wrestle with incipient Alzheimer's, how do two gentlemen of mature years retain such total recall of these events of long ago and far away, and how do they manage to do
I'm
it with such aplomb?
Him.
You're a month or two older.
6 months older.
6 months older.
But
well,
I
read the other day that drinking tea helped to ward off Alzheimer's. At least I thought I read it, and then I forgot. So, I'm
whereas each pipeful kills 100 brain cells, I'm told. thank you all very much for great questions, but particularly I want to thank our conversationalists, because I would David. Simply say, having embarrass those who are rather old at the beginning, let me embarrass those who are relatively young at the moment, including, I know, quite a lot of students here. You have just been present at LSE appropriately at a masterclass in politics, a masterclass in conversation, if I may say so, a masterclass in how to be candid and good friends over many years. And I think we're all very privileged to have been here and to have heard it. And for those who can't tear themselves away, I understand Tony is willing to sign some books, but will you now join me in thanking them both very much indeed?
Well, David, is that what you hoped?
Well, there's enough. It's what you wanted. It's what you wanted.
Well, great fun, and the balance between and enough darkness to make the door.
I'm going to write off for a costing out carriages.
You what?